Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, we're going to be talking about the pandemic and about some of the efforts underway here in Utah to help us get a handle on where outbreaks are occurring. And, well, just to give you fair warning, here's an audio representation of where we're going with this conversation. Yes, just like the world we're currently living in, today's show is going straight down the toilet. And for the first part of this discussion, we'll be guided by this guy.
My name is Keith Roper. I'm a professor and department head in biological engineering at Utah State University.
Utah State University's Dr. Roper has been deeply involved in an effort aimed at detecting SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, though becoming less novel all the time. Anyway, earlier this week, we reported here on KCPW that some dorms up at USU and Logan were being quarantined because testing had found coronavirus. But here's the thing, it wasn't that any individual person tested positive for the virus. No, the virus was detected in a more creative way.
The process for detecting it starts with sampling. We identify a location in what we call a sewer shed. A sewer shed is like a watershed, except instead of being a collection point for water, it collects wastewater. And at that point, we usually insert an auto sampler. Sometimes we take a manual sample, and we will take that sample over a defined period of time and then transport that to the laboratory, where our first step is to disinfect the sample, make sure that any potential infectious or pathogenic microbes are inactivated. We then clean up the sample, clarify it, and extract the ribonucleic acid, which is the genetic information associated with living organisms. Then we use quantitative polymerase chain reaction to distinguish which of that RNA, if any, comes from the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Just quickly before I forget about this, you said there's an auto sampler or manual sampling. Can you describe the difference between those two things?
Now, the auto sampler is a device that can be programmed to, for example, take one sample every several minutes of a defined volume over a period of time, say 24 hours, and keep those separate or pool those into a volume. A manual sample is a individual like myself, dressed in personal protective equipment, yeah, leaning down to pick up a sample.
And that's okay. That sounds like somewhat disgusting work, but maybe we'll come back to that in a minute. But the process that you just described in the RNA, the determining of whether or not the SARS-CoV-2 virus is present, that this week led to a sort of discovery at campus dorm facilities up there in Logan. Can you tell us about that, what that discovery was?
Yes. We began monitoring SARS-CoV-2 RNA on campus in student residence halls in July. And over the course of about a month and a half, almost 2 months now, have accumulated a database of SARS-CoV-2 RNA content across campus. We've also done that for the city, Logan City, several neighborhoods in the city, for Cache Valley, and for wastewater treatment plants across the state of Utah and environmental samples across the nation. Last week, there was indication amongst those samples that we took that there was SARS-CoV-2 RNA present in wastewater from a number of those dorm locations on campus at elevated levels. And the decision was made that the students in those locations ought to be tested to determine whether or not they were infectious. And as a result of the decision to be tested, it was necessary for them to be quarantined until those test results were complete.
And we're still waiting. I mean, currently, we don't know what the tests are going to show, but it's interesting because you're getting an earlier picture than even symptoms show. And that's because I guess, well, I mean, you're in biological engineering, but that's because, from my understanding, because the human body sheds the virus more quickly through its intestines, through fecal matter, than symptoms show up, which is just an interesting aspect of this. Is there any way of telling how many people have the virus in a given you know, I guess, sewage district or whatever you want to call it? Or is it just that it's present or isn't present?
There is an intense amount of effort being conducted right now to try to determine, based on the level of SARS-CoV-2 RNA in wastewater or other biological systems, what the number of infectious individuals that contribute to that is. And there are preliminary estimates available, for example, from Centers for Disease Control based on modeling. I think at this point, it's fairly preliminary. What we do not have in the United States at this point is a broad database to help us understand what the levels of SARS-CoV-2 RNA in the feces or urine of individuals who are infected. We have reports from overseas that value of RNA can vary depending on the individual, depending on the circumstances where they are in the illness. We know that as many as over half of individuals who are infected may be asymptomatic. Quite a large number of those individuals also shed SARS-CoV-2 RNA in their feces. And so this becomes a way to be able to identify subclinical cases of COVID-19, which can be infectious and transmit the virus, but may never show up in clinical case counts.
Which is amazing. I mean, it really is amazing that that is feasible. And it kind of makes me wonder if this is going to sound like a sort of bizarre question, but should we all be, you know, testing our sewage, our testing our poop, Dr. Roper? I mean, it's an interesting prospect, but is there a sort of practical, widespread or even universal way of using this method?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the advantages that wastewater testing or monitoring offers is the ability to characterize the prevalence of infection in quite a large population at a fairly moderate cost. So when we sample an influent to a wastewater, we may be collectively testing or pooling the results from a large number of individuals. In Cache Valley, that would be 40 or 50,000 individuals approximately from two wastewater influents. So that sort of canvassing allows us to have a long-term monitoring surveillance of a population in order to identify whether it's necessary to institute testing at a more local or individual level. And so in the case of Utah State University, we were able to identify a population that appeared to have elevated levels of the RNA in that population. And so rather than test all the students on campus or require all students on campus to be tested, it was deemed at this point useful to test just those students that when their wastewater was pooled appeared to have an elevated RNA content.
It sounds like also a little bit labor and well, I mean, aside from being maybe slightly disgusting, labor intensive in the fact that instead of looking at the sampling right at the, you know, the point of entry to a sewage treatment facility or whatever versus sampling in a very specific location, that sounds a little bit more difficult to do, requiring more labor, you know, more people actually going out and going to these sites to sample. Is that correct?
That's correct. The closer we get to a particular site or location, the more challenging the sampling becomes, and the more challenging the interpretation of the data becomes. When you're sampling a large number of individuals over a large area in a well-defined system, you can do that frequently and you can establish a good database. So there are challenges to sampling smaller and smaller numbers of individuals.
I don't know, Dr. Roper, we will have some other voices lined up to talk about this process and how it's being implemented in Utah. Some are from Division of Water Quality, for example. But is there anything else of interest that we're missing from this story?
I think what's valuable about wastewater monitoring is that it's an early warning capability. It provides advance notice of infection in a population from typically 4 to 6 days, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and from gleaning from a broad number of sources. And so it provides the ability to proactively take steps that would minimize transmission in a very well-defined population. And so in that sense, it becomes a sentinel or another tool that complements our clinical testing. I don't think at this point it's intended to displace clinical testing. That's still necessary to undertake the treatment of those individuals that have symptoms that need to be treated, as well as to do the case tracking and identify those who may have been exposed and suggest to them they might self-isolate. So what it provides is an additional measure that allows us not only to monitor populations, but also those individuals who may not have access to testing or to whom tests may not be available in socioeconomic circumstances where there may not be a large number of individual tests available. This provides an economic, cost-effective tool to monitor those populations and give them an early read if there is a change in the prevalence of the virus in that population.
Yeah, and also, of course, you know, for the people who maybe never decide to get tested because they're not showing symptoms, but who are carrying the virus anyway.
That's correct.
A quick question. I mean, you could conceivably, obviously, catch the coronavirus from the fecal matter, from a sample that you pull from the sewage, right?
It's a very important question. So a clear distinction needs to be made, and that is that the testing that we do detects the presence of the ribonucleic acid. It does not detect the presence of infectious virus. And so with that clear distinction, what's not known is the extent to which infectious virus is present in these samples. An infectious virus would need to be present in order to transmit the disease. And those studies, the facilities and the infrastructure necessary to conduct those studies is very difficult to access, primarily because most of it is used right now to look at clinical cases as well as to develop vaccines and treatments for SARS-CoV-2. So that information will come in due time, but right now it's not possible to say whether there is in fact infectious virus in these wastewater samples.
Is this work not just a little bit disgusting? I mean, when you do, say, gear up and do the manual sampling, is it nauseating? Did you expect to be doing this work ever, Dr. Roper?
When I first became aware of wastewater monitoring earlier this year, I was skeptical. I was frankly skeptical that such a complex sample with so many variables could provide a reproducible and quantitative measure of the level and rate of increase or decrease of the infection in a population. And part of my reason for getting involved was to demonstrate that with very careful sample collection and processing and analysis, that in fact, there were serious issues with it. And I admit I've come full circle after diving in and taking samples and processing them and getting over the yuck factor, as it will. All of what we do is done in a very well-contained area to minimize the potential for transmission of any infectious agent from the samples to our workers. They're in personal protective equipment. All the samples are handled in biosafety cabinets and other places, and the rooms themselves have negative air pressure. So we have multiple levels of containment to prevent any sort of contamination or in infection mode. And I have to admit that after months of doing this, when I do go to a public restroom or a national park, I often start to wonder if maybe there might be some interesting RNA that I could sample, but I resist. So
that's, well, I mean, this is the curiosity that drives science. Keith Roper, head of the Department of Biological Engineering at Utah State University, thanks for telling us all about this.
We have to appreciate your interest in science.
Dr. Roper mentioned earlier that these efforts weren't just focused on testing sewage in and around Utah State University and Logan. In fact, the state of Utah has been involved in documenting the spread of the pandemic virus using the same technique. And to understand just how widespread that testing is and how important it is in our fight against the virus, I spoke with Dr. Erica Gaddis.
Sure. My name is Erica Gaddis. I'm the director of the Division of Water Quality at Utah's Department of Environmental Quality. We're the agency in the state that regulates wastewater. So right now we're sampling at 43 facilities across the state on a weekly basis. That covers about 80% of the state's population. These are the larger facilities that are more well-equipped to collect these sorts of samples. They range in terms of population size, of serving up to 1,000 people all the way up to several hundred thousand people. So pretty big range in the size of facility. Sewage treatment plants, yeah. We're largely looking at trends in the data. There's a lot of variability. You may have heard that from Dr. Roper. So we're really using the data to help identify and confirm trends in various parts of the state with respect to COVID-19.
One thing to note, I guess, is that after the water is, you know, goes through the sewage treatment plants and then is filtered and treated, the water that goes back out into the world doesn't have the virus, right?
That's right. We haven't seen any evidence of it in the effluent that's going back into the state's rivers, streams, and lakes. So this is largely a public health surveillance tool.
How specific? I mean, you said that it's in these sewage treatment plants. I talked to Dr. Roper, and they're doing that very specific, site-specific test that led to the quarantine of some students at specific dorms at Utah State University. Do you have anything that's really kind of on the micro level like that for the state?
Not really. Probably the closest would be a few facilities in rural parts of the state, like Daggett County and Fillmore City. And both of those are showing no detection of virus over the last few weeks. And that's actually a really useful outcome, since there's not a lot of testing in some of the more rural areas of Utah, to be able to use wastewater to give some confidence to the public that there's relatively low levels in some of those areas.
I think it's fascinating that that, you know, it provides a kind of early detection. It's earlier than, you know, symptoms show up, for example. And I'm wondering if this technique might eventually be put to best use in places like long-term care facilities, where you could know, you know, say 5 or 6 days in advance that the, you know, in advance of the onset of symptoms, that someone at the facility has the virus, and then essentially as a result, test everyone there and possibly head off a disaster. Is that something that might be in the cards down the road?
It's certainly something we've talked about. You know, we wanted to get started at the community scale. The sampling is easier once it's coming into a wastewater treatment plant. Obviously, the success that they've had, if you call it that, up at Utah State in terms of identifying a potential outbreak early, gives us reason to think we should take a look at that. There's a lot of long-term care facilities in the state. So there's a capacity question as well. It's where do we best target this tool to get the most useful information statewide? Maybe I'll say that, you know, in terms of increasing trends, we were able to detect that outbreak in Hiram at the JBS Swift plant in late May. So we saw that, you know, a few days up to a week before you started to see those large case counts. Right now we're seeing increases in some parts of the state, and we're working closely with the Department of Health and those local health departments so that they're aware of potential increases in their communities.
Do you have any, this is kind of a throwout question, but are there any sort of privacy concerns when it comes to the state knowing about what's, you know, in your poop? I don't know how to ask this question. Yeah.
This is one of the questions that has to be considered when we get to that smaller scale. I mean, certainly when you're looking at 200,000 people and you have a composite sample, it's really giving you a community level idea of what's going on. There's really no way to identify any individuals or even individual households using this technique. So for the most part, we think the privacy issues, if you started thinking about long-term care facilities, you know, certainly the privacy question would need to be considered.
Okay. And then Dr. Gaddis, I've eaten up a lot of our time. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this technique and how your department and health officials are using the data that it provides?
Maybe just one other. You know, in addition to identifying areas where there's increasing virus and also areas where there's been non-detects, we've also been able to confirm the declining trends in some parts of the state, such as Salt Lake County, starting in late June, and also in Logan City. Parts of Cache Valley. And that's really helpful because I know as testing goes up and down in terms of you know, how much testing we're doing, having that sort of broad scale trend that we can see in the wastewater helps provide a little bit more confidence that what we're seeing in the case counts is real.
Again, that was Erica Gaddis, Director of the Division of Water Quality with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, talking about the sampling of sewage heading into treatment plants across the state. to help health officials track coronavirus. You can check out the state's data on this yourself at wastewatervirus.utah.gov. So far on the show, we've been talking very specifically about tracking the pandemic virus. But both of these conversations got us wondering about the background, the origin of the technique, and how else it's being used. Meaning, what else are researchers looking at in the sewers, aside from, you know, mythological giant rats and alligators? And for that, KCPW producer Tim Pierce spoke with...
So my name is Jennifer Wiedes. I'm an environmental engineering associate professor at the University of Utah. And I do a lot of work on waterborne pathogens and water testing.
To start with, Tim asked Dr. Wiedes about something that I had kind of led Tim astray on. I thought she was looking at the prevalence of things like opioids in our water systems, but it turns out I was wrong.
Okay, so just to clarify, I have not tested for like opioids or chemicals in wastewater for purpose of like public health monitoring. With that respect, but I have tested for other waterborne pathogens. So like you might have a norovirus outbreak where you know, that's the one that makes you sick for 24 hours that everybody gets once a year sometimes. So those kind of microorganisms we routinely test for in wastewater. And in my field, at least, you know, we're doing it for disease monitoring. We're trying to see general health of the community. Is there an outbreak occurring somewhere? Are there reasons why that outbreak might be occurring that's coming from the environmental engineering side? Because we can use these same tools that we're using to test wastewater to also test drinking water to make sure it's safe. Or we might be able to test in a stream or a river here in Utah to see whether, you know, there's animals that are contributing to poor water quality, or is it like there's a leaking septic tank that's actually getting into the water?
Well, what is the spectrum of information that you can glean from your testing and your work?
Well, with respect to wastewater, there are all sorts of things that are present in wastewater that would surprise people, right? We tend to, you know, flush the toilet or take a shower or wash our dishes and put things down the drain and don't think about it. It just goes away, which we're all happy with, me included. But there's lots of information in there. So it's well known that if you take Tylenol for pain medication, not all of that is processed in your body and some of it is excreted in urine. Similarly, you know, we can measure heartburn medication and the amount of heartburn medication that a community might have based off of that hormone in the water. There's a famous case out of London where they can actually measure antidepressants in the wastewater there and see differing levels, winter versus summer and depending on how much sun there is. There's a lot of information available in wastewater. We tend to use it more for, you know, helping our public health partners understand what's going on at a community level. We can't look at an individual house or individual person, but we can get a feeling for what are the trends in a community.
It seems like data collection is what you're doing, right? But what do you do with the data?
Yeah, okay. So here's an example. I might be interested in a wastewater treatment plant and how well that wastewater treatment plant is removing, let's say, Tylenol or other pharmaceuticals through their treatment system. And then here in Utah, we take that treated wastewater. And in some communities, it is actually used as secondary water or irrigation water, right? So I could test for the level of those compounds leaving the treatment plant and get an estimate for how much people might be spraying on their lawns or putting in their pools, which they're really not supposed to be using the water for that purpose, or letting their kids play in the sprinklers, right? So from a risk assessment point of view, I can take that concentration of Tylenol or heartburn medication that I know is in the secondary water that people are irrigating their garden with, and I can estimate, well, okay, how many, if the carrots or tomatoes in your garden, for instance, took up that Tylenol, how many tomatoes would I need to eat before I got the same dose of Tylenol as if you took a pill? Well, luckily, you have to eat like a whole truckload full of tomatoes, but that's the use of the kind of information. We can do a sort of a risk assessment. What's the risk to people from exposure to those things in the water?
Are there any more like noxious chemicals that can be found in this that takes precedence? Like, again, you said you haven't tested opioids, but is that something in theory that could be found? And you know, because I'm much more concerned about, are my tomatoes laced with opioids than are they, you know, laced with ibuprofen, right?
Yeah, no, I understand. So in theory, all of those things can be tested for, but, you know, we are exposed to thousands of chemicals on a daily basis, and some of those make it into our wastewater treatment systems. Some of them we take as medication and aren't fully metabolized in our body, and they pass it in urine and feces. So there's going to be, you know, thousands of potential things we could test for in the water. The question always comes back to the science. What, as you indicated, why are you collecting that data, and what are you going to do with that data? So yes, in theory, I could test for opioids and uptake in the vegetables in my garden if the treatment plant didn't remove it. And some of the treatment plants in Utah are, you know, state of the art, and they're really good at making really clean water. Some of them, you know, they're not as good. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a risk to people. It's just they don't have the same treatment standards.
So can this data collection, this information that you provide, be used to improve those standards that they have?
You have to remember, though, that those facilities are very expensive to upgrade. And who pays for that upgrade? It's the people who are paying their utility fees and occasionally money from the EPA or state if available to upgrade. Like, these are hundreds of millions of dollars of upgrade to these facilities. So we don't want to be too reactionary, right? Science helps inform the government and the public. What we can do is provide data about certain things that they probably want to look into more, and then they need to do an evaluation. So what if this is present in my wastewater coming into my treatment plant or even leaving my treatment plant? What is the impact to the Jordan River, for example, or the fish in the Jordan River? What is the impact to people who might be recreating in the Great Salt Lake, where that water ultimately goes to? If there's not really a risk to the ecosystem or to the people, then you would argue that it's not a great concern for the utility to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to upgrade their facility to treat that one thing. And oftentimes, yeah, it's what we don't know that might be a problem. So there's always some concern about emerging contaminants. So, you know, the fluorinated firefighting foams or dioxins or other things that are actually carcinogens. So those are the things that we tend to be more concerned about and look at when we're redesigning treatment systems.
This might sound like an odd question. Are there any sort of like privacy issues people would have to consider, like you have to consider about this? I know you said you couldn't test individual houses, but I guess like what is the smallest scope that you can look at?
Well, I mean, we can always go to the sewer mains in the middle of a seat, right? A street. I'm on a cul-de-sac, so I could, in theory, if I had public, the city approval, I could open the sewer main in front of my house, and I could collect wastewater from the five facilities on my block. Now, I'm not going to do that, and I don't know what information that would really provide me about those individuals.
And again, that was Jennifer Wiedes, Associate Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Utah, speaking with KCPW producer Tim Pierce, and wrapping up this edition of In the Hive, looking at science in the sewers. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay safe, and join us again next week.